and it will tell us many interesting things about observables in perturbative.
Thank you, Michaela. All right, so yes, I would like to tell you about some work that I've been doing with Steve Giddings on observables in perturbative de-Sitter quantum gravity. And you know, the first question in most people's mind when they see a title like this, or I tell them about the project, is why bother? What's, you know, what is there to do? After all, you know, there are people who worry about observables, but usually they worry about deep issues involving the non-perturbative theory and so forth. Why confine yourself to a perturbative theory? What, and from that point of view, if it's perturbation theory, don't we know everything? You know, what is there really to learn? Well, there are some technical bits that I'll fill you in on shortly, but certainly, most people would agree that de Sitter space is an interesting context in which to understand gravity, especially in the more if one uses that as a test bed for moving on to generalizations such as inflation, perhaps eternal inflation, more complicated things we don't understand very well. And it's good to ground oneself in simple cases. So that's perhaps enough motivation to study de Sitter in infinite detail. It also turns out, though, that the issues of constructing observables, even in de Sitter space, are non-trivial. And I think they provide an interesting test bed, interesting toy model, if you like, for issues that may arise in a more complete non-perturbative description of quantum gravity. And the nice thing about working in perturbation theory is that we don't have to pretend that we know anything about the deep, full theory of quantum gravity. And we might, therefore, optimistically believe that we could learn lessons here that would be valid no matter what the final theory is. We sort of approach independent. We might optimistically believe that. We can discuss that as we go along. All right. So I'm going to start out by saying a few words about doing perturbation theory around de Sitter space, basically to explain why this is an interesting thing to do and why there is this issue of observables whatsoever. For those people who are familiar with this story, what I'm going to do is retell the story of linearization stability constraints and talk about what they have to do with observables and gauge invariants. And so if you know what that means, you know why there may or may not be something interesting to do in this context. If you don't know what it means, I'll remind you or educate you during the first part. I'll then talk about some strategies that we have for producing observables and constructing them. There's a class of observables, of potential observables that we like to call single integral observables, which one might think would be very nice, and one can try to study them, but they have certain issues associated with them, problems, if you will, which I feel or we feel are connected to a topic you sometimes hear about in connection with de Sitter space, which is known as the Boltzmann brain issue. We'll talk about that later. I find this interesting in part because the Boltzmann brain issue often strikes me as a fuzzy, somewhat nebulous, ill-defined issue, but I would argue that it has at least some connection to a well-defined problem in mathematical physics. I should not stand near that speaker, I see. Someone's BlackBerry. Imagine that here. Okay. So what I find interesting here is that there's this sort of fuzzy issue of Boltzmann brains that I claim has some at least connection to a well-defined issue in mathematical physics that arises in our construction of observables. Okay, I'll then talk about how we resolve, let's see, is there a laser pointer on this gizmo? Or if I push a button, will everything die? That looks like a pointer. Okay. I will then talk about how to resolve the technical problem that arose here. And it's very interesting because, you see, we're not just trying to construct any old observable. We're actually, well, as many of you know, when you try to construct observables in quantum gravity, the most natural candidates often appear rather non-local from certain points of view. That will be the case for ours. They will look very non-local at first sight. We are interested in trying to understand in what sense there is some regime of the theory or limit of the theory in which they behave approximately locally. We term such observables that we want to be, that will behave approximately locally under the appropriate conditions. We call those proto-local. And the interesting story is going to be that in order to resolve this technical problem, it appears to us, or at least the resolution we've found, is that you can do that, and you make the observables proto-local, having these sort of local limiting behavior, basically in a limit where h-bar goes to 0, and the theory becomes classical gravity on coupled to a quantum fields. Sorry, it becomes classical gravity coupled to quantum fields on the, well, maybe it's better to say it's just quantum field theory propagating on a fixed space-time background. In that limit, you can make these proto-local observables, but you have to really, they have to be even more non-local than we might have thought at first. Okay, so that's the interesting lesson. It requires really use of global information in an interesting way. So I'll try to explain what I mean by that at the end of the talk. All right, so to start off, ask me that at the end of the talk. I think it'll be easier to answer later. So as I say, De Sitter is, as I mentioned at the beginning, I consider De Sitter an interesting toy model where, in which I think we might learn to draw some conclusions about the full theory. Exactly which, well, let's discuss that at the end. Okay. All right. So, good. So, how do you do perturbation theory for quantum gravity on De Sitter space, or what do I mean by perturbation theory? Well, I'm really interested, I find it easiest to think about this in the context where I have some matter quantum field theory, which is going to interact with gravity. And when I say that I want this to be perturbative, I want to emphasize that I'm only talking about perturbation theory in Newton's constant, the Planck scale. I'm happy to have the quantum field theory be treated in some non-perturbative fashion. Alex, you had a question.
Maybe I missed this question.
Okay.
What do you mean by quantum gravity on De Sitter?
I will tell you what I mean. Okay. I mean, perturbative quantum gravity done in perturbation theory expanded around a classical De Sitter background. Okay? So again, the physical theory I have in mind is some set of matter fields, which I'll call a quantum field theory on the De Sitter background, coupled to gravitational fluctuations. Okay. And I want to think about expanding this theory. Oh, I have an analogy first. But the idea is I want to think about expanding this theory in powers of the gravitational interaction. So before I actually say anything about that, let me make an analogy with doing something like quantum electrodynamics on a De Sitter background. All right. There is perhaps more obvious what I mean. I just mean quantum field theory in curved space-time. But now I might imagine that I will treat the electromagnetic interaction perturbatively. So what's interesting about doing this on De Sitter, or if you like, any kind of closed cosmological solution, is that new information can arise after new information can arise at beyond the zeroth order in perturbation theory. By that I mean, at zeroth order in perturbation theory, we have just some Fock space of electrons, positrons, and photons. And at zeroth order, any state is allowed. But when we pass beyond the zeroth order and turn on the interaction, even by a tiny amount, we have something interesting. We have Gauss's law. Gauss's law, of course, is a constraint. It has the property that it allows us to measure the charge inside any given region through a surface integral, which is just the electric flux through that surface. And of course, we all know that if we try to understand how to work with Gauss's law on a sphere, it's going to immediately tell us that because the circle that I've drawn here can be viewed as measuring the charge either inside the sphere or outside the sphere, it tells us those two numbers must be equal and opposite. And so the total charge on the sphere has to vanish. So what's interesting about working in perturbation theory on some spatially compact manifold is that there are these additional constraints that arise in the interacting theory that are not present in the free theory. So if you're doing QED, yes, Lee.
Yeah, so I mean, Gauss's law is present in the free theory.
Gauss's law is present in the free theory. Gauss's law is present, but rho is always zero. So the global constraint, there is no global constraint. So it is true that Gauss's law is present, yes. But as I say, at zeroth order, the charge density on the right side is zero. So at zeroth order, it is Gauss's law does not constrain the Fock space. Let me say it this way.
Right.
So let me say it this way. Gauss's law has a similar local expression at zeroth order and first order. If I were to take Gauss's law and Fourier transform it, decompose what it means in spherical harmonics, what I find is that at zeroth order, the zeroth harmonic, okay, the rotation into the zero mode, is completely trivial. It's identically zero. because I'm integrating a total divergence. Okay, it's those higher angular momentum terms are non-trivial, and they require the photon to have no longitudinal part. Okay. So at first order, if I perform the same decomposition, I again find that the higher harmonics, what they do is they basically say the photon has no longitudinal part plus some little correction that comes from the charge. But there's now a brand new constraint that is not a small perturbation of any of the zeroth order constraints. So really what's going on here is I'm claiming there is not a field's worth of new constraints at first order, but one new constraint, just one. It's a global constraint, requires the total charge to vanish.
Are you happy with saying it this way, that of the free Fock space, there's only a sector which has perturbation theory defined on it, which is the sector of zero charge?
I am very happy to say that. I'm very happy to say. In fact, I think in some version of this talk, I have exactly that written down. Exactly. Of the free Fock space, the only states with consistent perturbative interactions, and in fact, on a more careful analysis, the only states with consistent non-perturbative interactions are those with zero total charge. So there's this new constraint in this theory that charge should vanish. And it's sort of clear how you would handle this if you're doing perturbative QED. You would do what Lee said. You would treat the theory without worrying about this constraint. You would just consider arbitrary states and start calculating things. But in the end, you would restrict yourself to states where the total charge vanishes, and you'd be very happy. So in other words, it's way at the bottom. you would just restrict the allowed states that you consider by requiring that the total electric charge annihilate them. That's as far as it goes. OK.
What if I did QED last license? How would this go?
All right, so this is an interesting question. Yes. So if you just solve the equation of motion with flat slicing, and you don't try to impose any particular boundary conditions at the end of the slice, then of course the states are not restricted. There's still a Gauss's law. It would tell you that suppose you had one of these flat slices, and you put some large amount of charge on it, okay? It would tell you that there's some large electric flux at the end of your slice. Okay? Now, the question is, what are the rules for quantum field theory, or what are the rules for building Hilbert spaces, if you like, with these open, flat slices? This is somewhat related to the talk I gave the other day. At least, let me try to give a classical physics answer, and then we can try to discuss later what the right quantum version of that is. At the classical physics level, I might ask myself whether I can build what boundary conditions allow me to build a good phase space on these flat slices. If I impose no boundary conditions, then usually there's something that diverges. The symplectic structure is infinite. There are norms of states that diverge. This is a problem. I end up with superselection sectors. You know, something complicated happens. I have not actually studied the details of this flat slicing in either QED or gravity. But what I would expect happens, because it happens in other situations, is that there are two options. You can either impose that on these flat slices, the fields sort of fall off at infinity. If you do that, then you should be able to define states with non-zero charge, and the global charge is some well-defined operator, and that's fine. Okay, but it requires that you consider states that are sort of not of the homogeneous cosmological type, but instead have some preferred behavior where the fields vanish at infinity. That should be an allowed way to define the theory. The other way to define the theory would be that you somehow allow the fields to fluctuate at the boundary. And if you're allowing the gauge fields to fluctuate at the boundary, then I think what happens is that even in that case, you end up with something like this constraint that the global charge vanishes. There is in the analogous case of gravity on anti-de Sitter space, which I talked about on Tuesday, that's exactly what happens. So that's my answer. I think there are two ways of looking at it.
What if you just took the condition that whatever you defined extended consistently to the full consider space?
Then you clearly have this.
Well, you have something. Something for the total charge vanishing. Is that the same? I mean, there could be charge out there somewhere else outside your slice. which compensators. So I'm just wondering if that picks out one of your possible boundary conditions.
Yes, I think that is, in some sense, this imposing conditions that things sort of fall off at infinity in a nice way. It makes them be not too big.
It just ends up being a super selection sector. You have to hide. I think you're just hiding your negative charge.
Yes. 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 Indeed. Indeed. Okay. So, I'd like to think about it. I'd like to study the center space this way, in which we use these compact slices and see what happens. All right. So, this is the story in E&M. It's transparent. We all understand it. The simple news, if you're not familiar with this, is that there is a similar story that happens for gravity. No surprise, gravity and E&M are extremely similar in many ways. So, how does that work? Well, this is known as the story of linearization stability constraints in perturbative gravity. Here are some authors who have worked on this issue. And, well, the story is very much the same. In our case, again, let's think about now this perturbative gravity discussion where I have some matter theory. And I imagine the matter theory is coupled to gravity. And I'm going to expand the entire theory in perturbatively in powers of the Planck scale. In that case, at zeroth order, the theory consists of the matter theory plus free gravitons. Again, I'm happy to allow the matter field theory to have strong interactions that are not perturbatively expanded. And then at higher orders, we add the interactions. So we can look at the analog of Gauss's law in the gravitational theory, which is just the Hamiltonian constraints. And if you think about what their form is and you work out the details, I have a particular way that I like to think about this, which I'll sort of motivate. This constraints, of course, has a perturbative expansion. Before I show any equations, it's obvious what the lowest order term does. The lowest order term is supposed to generate the gauge transformations of the linearized theory, right? It's the lowest order term. This is the generator of gauge transformations. It must generate the gauge transformations of the linearized theory. What are the gauge transformations of the linearized theory? Well, in linearized gravity, the gauge transformations are exactly that you can add to the gravitational fluctuation something given by acting with a Lie derivative on the background of the space. Okay? Maybe I'll write an equation over here. Ah, no chalk here.
Over there.
Over here, okay. Great. Well, this is a simple, I just want to remind you that in linearized gravity, the gauge transformations are that the perturbation changes by something involving a Lie derivative of the vector field along the background. Okay. So that's what the lowest order linearized terms do. I have a way of writing them which involves a certain amount of notation, but which basically says that this just says that if you commute something with the constraint, you get something which is the Lie derivative of the background along some vector field. You don't need to digest the notation if you understand what I said over here. But of course, at some order, you know that other things come in. This lowest order term clearly has only to do with the gravitational field. It doesn't know about these other matter degrees of freedom, because at lowest order in perturbation theory, we know that these degrees of freedom are gauge invariant.
What is your surface?
What is what? Oh, it's some arbitrary Cauchy surface of the... So Q would be the metric projected to the spatial slice. QDS is the background de Sitter metric that you're expanding around.
What's H?
And then H is the perturbation of Q.
Perturbation
of Q. The notation really is not important here.
You say Hamiltonian constraints. You really just mean all the constraints.
I mean all the constraints, indeed. I'm thinking here of Xi as, well, I have a... I'm really thinking of here of Xi as a vector field chosen on de Sitter space, which I then use the de Sitter background metric to break into a lapse and shift and construct some set of Hamiltonian constraints. Indeed. Indeed. But I mean all the constraints. Very good. All right. So at linear order, it's just this thing that generates the linearized gauge transformations. At higher order, quantities associated with the matter theory have to come in. And of course, what should come in is the stress tensor in some way. And It will not surprise you if I claim that you can write the second, the first non-trivial term as something that's like a stress tensor for the matter theory plus free gravitons contracted with a normal to the slice and the field whose transformation you're trying to generate. Good. So what's interesting, of course, is that the same thing happens here as happened in the electromagnetic case. In general, these constraints are non-trivial, even at the zeroth order. But for the special case where I choose this vector field to be a killing field of background de Sitter space, it's clear that the transformation generated is trivial at zeroth order. Okay? It therefore follows that this linear piece here also vanishes identically when this vector field is a killing field in Sitter space. So for those choices of C, we find a few new, brand new constraints at first non-trivial order. Just saying that for those C's, these vanish. And the constraints are, the lowest order term in those constraints comes from this piece here. And you see what it says. It says the integral of the stress tensor for the zeroth order theory, this guy, when contracted with a killing field of the Sitter space and a normal, and integrated, should be zero. Those are, of course, just the conserved global de Sitter charges of the zeroth order theory. So it's just the analog we saw for E and M. The total charges have to vanish in order for the zeroth order states to couple consistently to the gravitational interactions. OK. Is that clear? OK. That's correct. That is correct.
No surprises.
No surprises there. Good. OK. So this has some implications. One implication is that, again, if we're going to do this in the quantum theory, we should think about requiring that our zeroth order states are, in fact, annihilated by what I'm now going to call the de Sitter charges corresponding to the killing field, corresponding to the killing fields. By that I mean just this stress tensor contract with a normal and the killing field integrated over a slice. Okay. There's a story about this that I will delay to later for the people who don't know about it, but for those of you who know about it, this is obviously this is something that cries out for group averaging techniques and so forth. So we can tell that story later. The issue is that if you actually look in the usual Fock space for a matter theory and free gravitons and try to find states that are annihilated by all the de Sitter charges, including those that are the de Sitter boosts that are kind of like de Sitter energy, you find that the only such state is the vacuum state, which makes your life somewhat complicated. But there are some techniques for dealing with that that I'll mention later. The other thing that you find is that, well, we agreed that we started with the Hamiltonian constraints. These are the objects that generate the gauge symmetries of the theory. So anything which is an observable should be invariant under those gauge transformations. So clearly, we should be requiring all of the observables of the theory to commute with all of the constraints, in particular those constraints where I plug in a killing field. Therefore, at lowest order for those constraints, we are requiring that the observables be de Sitter invariant. They're invariant under the action of all the de Sitter charges. Okay. This means that the observables themselves are now something interesting to study. Bob, you had a question?
Can I ask a question about your first condition?
Sure.
So another way I could have started is I could have said, let me have gravity coupled to some matter, and I've also got a cosmological constant, whatever. And
yes.
I could have said, what kind of asymptotic conditions do the fields have to behave to make sure that I really have some solution that looks asymptotic to like de Sitter space?
You could. No.
Maybe do yes. Some so the conditions yeah. that I get on, say, the matter and the gravitons in that first condition, is that different than what I would get by, say, taking the linearized equations and making sure that the behavior of the matter fields was consistent with having an asymptotically de Sitter space time?
This depends on what you mean. So this is, in some sense, the condition that if I'm working on this, if I'm looking at a spatial slice, which is the sphere, that the metric closes up smoothly on the sphere, I don't know whether that's what you would call being asymptotically desitter or not, but there's a, you know, you move off in some direction and there's some boundary condition that comes in. That implies this. Nothing has been said so far about the behavior of the space-time in the distant future in PECS, okay, which is a logically distinct kind of question. Okay. So there is some tie-in to the kind of things you're used to thinking about, but in that direction. Okay. So this makes this problem of finding observables interesting, because we, of course, believe that if we do something like perturbative gravity in de Sitter space, we should be able to describe that in terms of local physics. There should be some notion of local physics that lives there. And yet, it seems at first sight that, well, in fact, what we have stated is that those things which are the gauge invariant quantities in this theory are precisely de Sitter invariants. They don't distinguish any one point on de Sitter space from any other. So the question is, what's the story? What are the observables? And how do we proceed, at least in some limit and in some perhaps special cases, to recover some notion of local physics that we would understand? In other words, how do we actually find a way of recovering at least a large part of the zeroth order theory as a limit of the interacting theory? Okay, so to many of you, this will sound like just doing non-perturbative quantum gravity at this point. There are many similarities in discussing observables. Yep, it's just the name for this guy. Yeah. Exactly. And of course, well, right. So it doesn't make much difference to me whether we think about this QC as being exactly this guy or this guy plus small corrections that come at higher orders in perturbation theory. It's still just some corrected notion of de Sitter invariants. Classically, one knows that there are no brand new constraints that arise at higher order. That is correct. And so formally, at the quantum level, the same thing is true. Good. Yes? Well, there's certainly a question. I mean, I'm not making an argument for it. Well, let's see. I have written down something that was a priori based on local dynamics. This is either equations that follow from a, at least classically, from a local action principle and so forth. But we learn that the observables must be de Sitter invariant, which has at least some flavor of non-locality about it. The details we can try to ferret out by studying further. Yes. Mm-hmm. Conveys to me, just meaning at this point that the local fields of this theory are certainly not observables. They are not de Sitter invariant. So what is? Let's find out. Okay. Let's talk about it at the end. Yes. All right. Oh, some people find it useful if I ground this abstract discussion in a piece of somewhat familiar physics. So people who have thought about de Sitter space often worry about black hole solutions in de Sitter space. And one of the things that strikes many students when they look at the, quote, de Sitter Schwarzschild solution is that it's a solution that actually has two or more, depending on how you look at it, black holes in the space-time. The standard solution with the fewest number of black holes has a black hole sitting on sort of one side of the space and a black hole sitting on the other side of the space. And many students of the years have asked themselves, is this just the simplest solution that some textbook wrote down, or is there some reason why I should always think about de Sitter black holes as being compensated by something on the other side of the de Sitter horizon? And the answer is that there's a sense in which you should always think about an object here on de Sitter space as being balanced by something on the other side. It can be seen in terms of these linearization stability constraints. So this is an intuition building exercise, but it shows you what these constraints mean. Let's think not about black holes, because those are sort of intrinsically non-perturbative, so it's clear my discussion on the previous slide doesn't strictly apply. Let's do this for stars. Imagine the star is small and diffuse, so I can treat it as a perturbation of de Sitter. Then I should ask myself, is it possible to build a solution with a star just on one side of de Sitter space and otherwise empty de Sitter space? If you actually try to solve the Einstein equation, assuming spherical symmetry or something, you find out it doesn't work. And why not? It's because the configuration would violate these linearization stability constraints, right? If I have two stars, one on this side and one on this side, then if I consider the killing field I have drawn of De Sitter space, a boost, since it is future-directed here and past-directed here, when I contract it with the star's stress energy, I get a different sign here than I do over here. And the integral gives me 0. The constraints are satisfied. The constraint roughly looks like m from integrating on this side minus m from integrating over here on the other side. On the other hand, clearly, if I tried to put a star just on one side, because its stress energy is positive, if it only extended in the region where this killing field was future directed, there'd be no way to balance it on the other side. So it's clear that there is no solution that is De Sitter space plus one star, or no solution that is this global De Sitter space plus a single star. Okay. All right. So we'd like to build some observables. Well, you know, what do we do? If we were very strong mathematicians, perhaps we'd find a way to classify all possible observables and give a, you know, organized algorithmic discussion. But we're not, so we're not going to do that. Instead, we're going to take some physical inspiration and guess a few ways we might try to build observables based on this idea they should be De Sitter invariant. So actually, first one is not at all new. I learned how to do this from my advisor, Bryce DeWitt, many years ago. It's been an idea that's been around for a long time. If you want something which is invariant under all the isometries of the manifold, or even under all diffeomorphisms, how about you take some local density, square root minus g times some scalar, and you integrate it over the manifold. That certainly, if the integral converges and makes sense, is De Sitter invariant. So let's study that object and see what we can say about it. OK, that's type 1 for the observables we're going to consider. I'll mention that it's also useful to do the following. Instead of integrating over the space-time, you can do something similar where you integrate over the De Sitter group. Okay? In this context, what you imagine doing is you take some operator, which in this case may or may not be a local field, it's just some operator, in the original zeroth order theory, and you conjugate it by a group element, and you do the integral. Again, if the integral converges, it's clearly invariant under all the De Sitter translations, under the action of the De Sitter group. Okay, both of these are interesting as examples of ways you might build observables. Good. So, I'll mention that, there was this slight issue that I briefly mentioned about not having many states in the original Hilbert space which satisfy this linearization stability constraint. In order to keep certain technicalities aside for the uninitiated, I'm going to ignore that as much as possible. The point is basically that there's this usual Fox space one works on that doesn't have many states in it. I claim to have an algorithm that I'll show you later, but not quite yet, for building a better Hilbert space from that original Fox space. Okay? If it's a good algorithm, it will have the property that if I find an observable on the original Fox space, it will in fact give me an observable on this better Fox space. In other words, I claim that my renormalization procedure is not changing the algebra of observables significantly, it's merely changing the states. For that reason, I will happily look for observables that are well-defined on the original Fox space. That makes sense. I have some Hilbert space. Most of its states don't satisfy the desired constraints, but there can still be many operators that act on that original space which commute with the constraint. Okay, so let's try to find them and see what happens. For me, this is really a presentational issue. I'm trying to keep some of the technical issues of how you construct these physical Hilbert spaces aside for the uninitiated. Okay. So let's look at these creatures. Start with this one, Raphael. I'll tell you in a moment.
Could you adopt an algebraic point of view where you're constructing an algebra?
Yes. So
that you don't need to worry about the group averaging or the pre-normalization. But in the end, you need to represent the algebra.
The answer is yes, you could construct that. You could take that point of view. You can. And you can interpret this group averaging as a technical tool for constructing a representation. I will just say, from taking that algebraic point of view, I still feel like I need the original Fox space in order to define what my full algebra is, to gain some control over it. Okay, but indeed, you can take very much that algebraic point of view, and I think I do. Yeah. Okay, so let's look at one of these observables, and ask the question, is it well-defined? I wrote down some crazy integral over the whole space-time. Does it converge? Yeah, that's the right question. Well, let's start with the simplest thing we can ask about, which is whether or not it converges weakly. That is to say, if I take matrix elements of this operator, does the integral converge? Okay. The answer is yes, for reasonable states. That is to say, this is a densely defined operator. And if you make reasonable choices of the integrand. Let's not worry about classifying the details, but how does the idea go? Let's first study this for free, the answer is yes in the case of a free field theory, and yes in the case of some other things I can control, and therefore presumably, well, plausibly this works in a large general class. So how does it work for free fields, and how would you proceed if you were studying now the matter interactions perturbatively as well? Well, you would take your operator, so you might think of your operator as being some polynomial in the fields, and you would expand it into normal modes that live on the space-time. One of the great things about De Sitter space is that it gets very large in the future, of course, it expands. And as a result, if you have conservation of Klein-Gordon norm, then at least for massive fields, it means the fields all become very weak and dilute in the future. So at least for massive fields, one finds that each mode falls off exponentially. And as a result, if there are enough powers of the field operator inside this A, I'll get a convergent integral. The point being that this volume factor, of course, is exponentially divergent, but with some fixed amount of exponential divergence, depends only on the dimension. And so for a given dimension, I can always choose the number of powers of the field operator in here to be high enough that the expression converges. Okay. In the case of massless fields, which you might worry about because you like gravitons, say, you get similar nice behavior if you take enough derivatives of the field. So there are operators built solely out of the graviton that also make sense and are finite for a similar reason. OK, so for free fields, this expression converges. And then it follows that it converges also whenever perturbation theory in the matter sector makes sense. A more interesting case to analyze, oh, sorry, I didn't actually finish this story. What I actually told you was that if you expand this mode by mode and then do the integral for each mode, the answer converges. But of course, we still have to sum over all the modes. So that's where you have to be careful about your choice of state. If the state has too much ultraviolet high energy behavior, the mode sum may not converge. But for reasonable states, if you put in, for example, some kind of ultraviolet cutoff, then it certainly converges. The point being that suppose I now introduce some notion of a positive definite energy-like quantity in De Sitter space. What is this creature? What I want to do is just, I have De Sitter space. I pick out, in any way I like, some minimal sphere in De Sitter space that I will call the neck. I pick one of these at random. There's, of course, many of them in De Sitter space, all related by the De Sitter isometry. So I pick one at random. And for that particular surface, I integrate the stress energy contracted with two normals over the surface. So that's something like an energy. It's, of course, not conserved in any way. If I change this surface to a higher surface farther up, the answer will change. But it gives me some way to define an operator that sort of counts how much stuff flows through my De Sitter space. And if I were to choose a state which, for example, has lives only in some bounded interval of the spectrum of this operator, then it turns out it can support that only a finite number of these modes I was talking about contribute, and again, the answer converges. So this is a way of regulating this calculation. So there exists a dense set of states on which this calculation makes sense. OK. I just wanted to say that the same thing, you can make the same argument for interacting but conformally invariant fields. To give us some insight into the interacting case. To understand that calculation, one simply remembers that De Sitter space can be conformally mapped to the Einstein static universe, but in doing so, it gives us only a finite piece of the Einstein static universe. Okay, so if your fields transform appropriately, if they have, it turns out, large conformal weight, so that when you do this mapping, they don't pick up if you do this appropriately, you get some, for the right choice of A, you get some integral over something which is obviously finite and compact, and so the integral turns out to be finite. So as long as you guarantee that this conformal transformation doesn't produce any explicitly divergent quantities inside the integrand, which it turns out happens when you choose the conformal weight appropriately, then you get a finite answer. So at the level of weak convergence for matrix elements, these observables make sense. All right. So these observables also, at least when studied within certain kinds of states, help us to recover some idea or some flavor of local physics. So we sometimes term these generic kinds of observables proto-local. This is just a brief sketch of the way that works. Consider an observable that looks like this. Let the, suppose that A of x is some polynomial in, say, some scalar fields just for simplicity. Let's suppose we have three flavors of scalar field that I've called phi, beta, and gamma. And I choose that A is phi, beta squared, gamma squared. The idea is that perhaps we can suppose that beta and gamma are fields we have control over. They represent the way we set up our detectors and the way we build a device in our laboratory. And what we're trying to do is to measure the value of the field phi. So if we consider a state which we have chosen, such that there are beta particles passing through the space-time and gamma particles, and they coincide and overlap only in some small region of space-time, then this integral, when acting on such states, will clearly give us something which is basically the value of the field phi smeared over the interaction region, over the regions where they cross. I shouldn't say interaction region. I haven't added any interactions. These are free fields, but smeared over the region where they cross. Right? This acts as some weighting function on phi. So in that sense, you can think about this as something which, in this scenario, imagine we can control the beta and gamma states. It would allow us to do to make an operator which acts very much like phi of x within this sector of states. OK. Great. Oh, I should say that it's sometimes useful to think in this language that what this operator does, which integrates over all space-time, sort of scans across all of space, and at each point it asks, what is the value of beta squared, gamma squared? At most places, it's essentially 0. And so in some sense, our detector is not present. At some places, it finds the detector. I should have said detector instead of observer, but it finds the detector. And at those places, it tries to record what phi is with some weighting.
So what's the difference between big psi and little psi?
Big psi and little psi. Yeah. That has to do with the technical details about group averaging that I'm suppressing for the moment. So I apologize. I edited an earlier version of the talk and should have changed that. Just think of that as a little psi.
Are there subtleties with your experiment having to do with this fact that the states have to have zero? I'm just thinking that in flat space, I can put particles in wherever I want, but you told me that I can't.
So the subtleties are that if I want to make my beta and gamma particles collide over here on this side of the space, I have to put something on the other side of the space to balance those out. But they could be particles of different fields. They could be things that don't collide. So the subtleties are not important. Good question, though. Very good question. All right, so everything looked great. I said, here we have these observables that converge weakly. And I say that there's some sense in which they, at least for a first pass, begin to tell us about some of the information we thought would be in local physics. But it turns out these things are, in fact, problematic. If you try to ask if these things are really well-defined operators, even on some dense subspace of the original Fock space, the answer is no. And you can see that by the fact that, you can see that by the fact that the two-point function diverges. This is a simple argument to see that it diverges, so let me just show you this. Let's write down what it would mean. That each operator is the integral over the space-time of some local expression. Oh, I seem to have forgotten to write down the square root of minus g's here, but they're not critical. Imagine that the volume element has been absorbed into the integration measure. So we just have to think about this two-point function between two arbitrary states. Now, the key point is that we're in the sitter space, and I'm working in the usual Fox space. So each of these states contains just some particle excitations on top of the de Sitter vacuum, by which I mean the de Sitter invariant vacuum. In that case, as time passes, the particles tend to fly apart, dilute, the wave functions decay. And so, in fact, if I were to fix the relative separation of A1 and A2, of X1 and X2, take those two points and push them sort of far off towards future infinity, then no matter what state Psi1 and Psi2 I choose, that correlator would become the same as the correlator in the vacuum, because all the particles are just diffusing and sort of going away. So there is a large part of the region of integration when I push A1 and A2 together off to either future infinity or past infinity, where this looks like a vacuum correlator. Okay. Right. As I said, the vacuum state is a kind of attractor state. So what that means is, I can think about this integral as being the same integral in the vacuum state plus a correction. That's, of course, the way this calculation actually comes out if you do it perturbatively anyway. You end up with a vacuum correlator and some particle excitations. I don't want to go through details here, but the particle excitations part give you what you expect. That's kind of the classical piece. And if I had a series of these experiments where I had various particles colliding and wanted to measure the values of fields, it is that term that I haven't written down from those particles that would give you what you would expect the correlator to look like. That is to say, this is a term in which this correlator looks like the product of two one-point functions. The details aren't critical here, because the interesting part is this one. The good term is also finite, it turns out. This one is not. This one is not finite, because it's the correlator in the vacuum integrated over all x1 and x2. And so what you see is that, well, the vacuum, remember, is de Sitter invariant. So if I were to act on x1 and x2 together with the de Sitter translation, nothing changes. So if I switch to sort of center of mass and relative separation variables, it's clear that the integral over the center of mass gives me some divergent factor of the space-time volume. So this looks something like some constant times the volume of de Sitter space, which looks bad. Okay. At this point in the talk, someone often asks me what the constant is and whether it might be zero. That's an important question to ask, because if you do the, because so far the words that I've said would also be true in Minkowski space. If I was doing perturbation theory around Minkowski space, I could have again argued that you basically have a vacuum correlator over a large part of region integration. I could argue that there's a translation invariance, and I could argue that that suggests some volume divergence. It happens that in Minkowski space, the coefficient is, in fact, zero due to energy conservation, which in Minkowski space, this would be integrating a positive frequency function over all space. And in that case, the integral over the relative separation gives you zero, because if you take a positive frequency function and integrate its argument over all time, it projects you onto the zero frequency subspace, but that's zero for a positive frequency function. Okay. In de Sitter space, though, there's no useful global notion of positive frequency, and that doesn't happen. If you study this in more detail, what you find is that, let's for simplicity think about the case of massive fields. So suppose that this A is some polynomial that involves sort of an n particle operator, and each particle involves some amount of mass. Then this coefficient turns out to be roughly the exponential, it certainly contains a factor that looks like the exponential of minus the sort of total mass that's involved in the operator divided by the de Sitter temperature. Perhaps not an unexpected result. After all, this is the kind of, the way that you see thermal effects in de Sitter space is to exactly take things that are like two-point functions and you integrate them over various regions. So it comes out here as the coefficient of the volume divergence. And so indeed, this factor goes to zero in Minkowski space as the de Sitter temperature goes to zero. But in de Sitter space, it's non-zero. So that's the story here. Let me explain this interesting factor coming up in this next bit and what these words best case means.
The volume is divergent, so when you have the constant time, the volume.
Possibly. What I mean is I change variables to the center of mass and relative coordinates, and I do the integral over the relative coordinates, and I get this expression. Okay. I would be happy to believe that someone else could find a way that makes it something else, but I don't think that's important. The important thing is that it's divergent, and that if I can find a way to make the, if I can find a way later in a few steps to regulate this integral over the center of mass degrees of freedom, I will have a friendly small number to help me remove this term. So that enters through this mass in the sense that suppose A is phi to the n, and the mass of a phi particle is m, then this sort of total mass in the operator A is n times phi. So it does depend on the choice of observable. Some observables are heavier than others. But it depends on it in a kind of a simple way. Or at least, as I say, this is certainly not the exact result, but there's a factor that sits there which is very interesting. So you might ask, you might ask if you can make this very small. Of course, given that there's an infinite coefficient, it's not clear how this is helping yet. But still, you might ask how small you can make this. And if you try to ask a question like, what's the largest mass of an object that you can stick into sitter space and treat in a way consistent with gravitational perturbation theory, it's sort of the size of a black hole that's the size of de Sitter space. And if you combine all those things together, since you only have the de Sitter scale and Newton's constant entering, sort of best you could possibly imagine doing was making this coefficient exponentially small in the de Sitter entry. Okay. So here we have this problem. These observables don't make sense. Oh, I'm rapidly running out of time. So what do we do? Well, let's look at this a different way. I was very happy with the one-point functions, with the inner products or matrix elements of the original O's. The problem is with these two-point functions. So suppose I think about writing the two-point function calculation as a sum over one-point function calculations. I insert a complete set of intermediate states in this way. So I'm happy with each of these factors separately. They're both finite. So if I could find some way to truncate this intermediate sum, to cut it off and have some finite number of states, I would clearly remove the divergence. And with luck, and if done the right way, I might be able to make it small and negligible, such that the term I like, the term that reproduced what I expected from my kind of local operators, would dominate. So how do we do that? Well, what we do, or a way you can proceed, this is kind of the just simplest possible way you could smash this problem with a sledgehammer, is you take your observable and you project it into some finite dimensional sector of your Hilbert space. Okay? What we have in mind doing, which I can say in words, and which I will not have time to go through the details of in this talk, but I'm happy to discuss at length in questions afterwards, what we imagine doing is that we take this flux operator I talked about before, the one that measured the amount of energy passing through some arbitrarily chosen neck of de Sitter space. So the definition of this operator breaks de Sitter invariance. We pick some kind of ultraviolet cutoff, some maximum flux or maximum energy we'd like to allow. We make it very high. And we restrict ourselves to states that are smaller energy than that maximum. That gives us some kind of bound. The trick is, of course, that we want to do this in some way which doesn't actually break the Sitter invariance, because I want my final object here to be a true observable, one that commutes with the de Sitter charges. So I want this O tilde to be de Sitter invariant. So that requires that P be de Sitter invariant. Well, you can do that basically by these group averaging techniques. What you do is you first make the operator that breaks the Sitter invariance, the states that are sort of low energy relative to some particular choice of this neck. And then you pull group averaging tricks to make them into de Sitter invariant states, and you use those to project onto your physical Hilbert, to project the operator down to a finite number of states. So I think if I'm going to have any hope of finishing by 3 o'clock, I can't go through those technical details at all. But I'm, as I said, very happy to explain that in more detail afterwards. So I'll quickly flash through the slides. There's group averaging. Here's what you do. You blah, blah, blah. And you make a thing that makes, you take these guys and you sort of group average them and you get a projector and it's all good. OK. Someone has a choice.
Bottom line, is this successful or not?
It appears to be. So the actual bottom line is that controlling the calculation, so successful in terms of making the fluctuations finite, yes, it certainly works. A calculation that I am in the process of doing, that I have a rough draft of, that I think is correct, but I wish to double check, and which is harder to control, is to show that after you regulate this divergence, so that the operator is now has finite fluctuations, I want to show that it still that correlators have this proto-local property. I want to show that if I put the two-point function of the projected operators into one of these situations where I imagine having particles collide to try to measure the average value of some other scalar fields from some region, that really, in some limit, the two-point function of these projected guys reduces to the two-point function of what would have been just local smeared phis in some quantum field theory on a fixed curve space-time background. That's the important property you want to preserve. So you want to show that monkeying with the operators and adding in these cutoffs doesn't destroy that property, okay? And it seems to work. And the physical idea is just that as long as you're trying to probe the system with operators that are kind of locally low energy and don't locally create things that would violate your possibly very high ultraviolet cutoff, why should it give you any problem? Okay. Showing calculating all the details is a little tricky, but it appears to work. And when the paper finally comes, when the new paper finally comes out, you can all check the details. Okay, Balak. Yes. Okay. Yes.
To be the cure in order to enable you to say that what one is after all is of a local quantity.
It's one part of the cure. I wouldn't say it's the cure, but it is an ingredient. Yes.
But I've been thinking about these things to understand that your point. That's why probably later on both like came up.
Okay.
That's completely devoid of this requirement in quotes of the symmetry of background space. I know that you have well-defined problem here,
mm-hmm.
and you can do the calculation.
Mm-hmm.
Space use the
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So my question is that I feel that it may not be necessary, or maybe there's an equivalent set of sort of criteria wherein one could make these two functions or even higher order functions finite or local.
That may be, that smells like something for us to discuss a little bit later. Yes, after the talk. That sounds like an extended private discussion as opposed to I'll have a short answer about it. Okay, very good.
Because, as you probably know, we've been, Enrique and I have been working with these two-point functions for a long time.
Yes.
Because that actually has the right local space to be in the Einstein equation. We keep the Hugo signal on the right hand side. And indeed, those are the voices.
Yes.
So the thing that one needs to do is really a kind of averaging the convolution. You need, because these things are distributions, you need to
specify
whereby that makes sense. And it's through those functions that you can see that it's actually effectively local in that sense. In fact, it doesn't make sense if one pushes the 2 points.
I should stress that the divergence I'm talking about here is, in the usual sense of doing a calculation of quantum field theory on a fixed background, an infrared divergence. This is not an ultraviolet divergence. Okay, and the infrared divergence comes in because of this requirement of de Sitter invariance that whatever you're doing has to be invariant of the de Sitter group.
Okay.
Okay. All right. Well, let's do that a bit later. 305. Yeah, so let me figure out what the right way is to sort of wrap this up in a nice way. So I showed you a problem, and I showed you a solution. It's a solution. I didn't show you the details of it, but the solution is you put in these nifty projectors, and it cures these infinities. Now, what's interesting, though, is that let me say it this way. For this particular concrete, we actually have generalizations of this. I can talk about various ways to cure the infinities, but they're kind of similar to this one. Let's stick with this concrete example for the moment. The way we curate them here was by restricting the states that are, if you like, of below some fixed energy in some reference frame. Now, oops, I didn't mean to do that. Now, note what's going to happen. If I restrict myself to states that have some fixed energy in this reference frame on this slice, as the disintegrator space expands, of course, everything gets redshifted. And that cutoff begins to come down and down and down. So there's some surface up here, higher up, where if I chose some cutoff on this at this sphere, at this surface, the cutoff has been redshifted to where it's now, say, the disintegrator link scale, to where I've ruled out from my observables the consideration of any dynamics which is shorter wavelength than the disintegrator scale. So at this point, I'm not going to be able to find any kind of local dynamics anymore in a useful sense, even in a useful approximate sense. So what that says is that this is a fix. It does produce operators that have roughly local properties in some limit. But it only gives you operators that are what we call proto-local in some limited region of de Sitter space of some finite size. Okay, and let me just say that all of the fixes for this problem and all of the schemes we have so far found to produce observables have the same feature. Whether or not there are other schemes that are more clever that some of you could think up is an open question in my mind, but at least everything we've thought of has this property that it only works within a finite region of de Sitter space. Note also another interesting property of our solution. We were trying to make operators that had at least some of the properties or reduced to local field operators in quantum field theory on curved space-time in some limit. Okay. In order to enact this fix, we really needed to choose, in this case, some actually global notion of an ultraviolet cutoff. I introduced an operator that integrates over this entire surface and knows about all the energy passing through de Sitter space. Okay. It is also true that every other solution to this problem that we have found has that in common, that you need to, in order to control the operator, some information about the global state of the quantum system has to come in. Okay. If someone wishes to ask me in the question period, that has to do with this business of Boltzmann brains, but let's not do that now. Instead, and so there's another way you can make observables by this averaging over the group. It's kind of similar. Let's skip to the summary, because I've now told you the key points. Let me just highlight them. So if you study the Sitter space in this way, with these closed spheres as spatial slices, you find that the Sitter symmetries are, in fact, gauge symmetries. This gives you constraints and a restriction that the observables be de Sitter invariant. We can then, it turns out we can, nonetheless, construct some interesting observables, or ones that we find interesting. There's a sense in which this encodes the old idea of relational dynamics. And we find that there is an approximation. We can discuss later, well, there's some kind of approximation in some sector of the Hilbert space where we can approximately recover local physics, but only over some regions of finite size. Now, I haven't gone through all the issues that are involved in constructing the operators or worried about various variations, but if in some back of the envelope estimations of how big of a region you could possibly study in this way, we tend to find that for the observables I've told you about, you seem to be confined to regions of de Sitter space that are in some sense smaller than a de Sitter entropy number of Hubble volumes. That is to say, we can't find in our own minds any scheme that gives us control over recovering anything like locality on a larger scale. Okay. Great. And again, the other interesting point that I emphasized at the end was that to make this work at all, to recover approximate locality even over small regions, I had to do something that killed off this infrared divergence. And the only way that we have so far found to do that is to make serious use of the global quantum state, operators that integrate over the entire surface or some characteristic of the global state, and to add that into our definition of the operators. Okay. I think that's my story. Thank you very much.
Thanks a lot.
And question.
So this whole thing is for this compact slicing, and it's topologically simple, but you can put quite complicated topologies onto sitter space where you can get.
All that matters is that it's spatially compact for this story.
Yeah, but what if you had a de Sitter space that had initial slice or some slice and was highly topologically non-trivial?
But still compact.
Yeah.
Yeah, same story works.
You're not going to find this.
Well, let's see. Actually, let me be more precise. We're doing this perturbatively, so.
I mean, your neck, you could have different necks, right? For example.
Yeah. Let's see. Actually, do we have a place to start? Is there a, I mean, if I put this extra topology in the space and then ask, if I want to do this perturbation theory business, I need some classical solution to expand around. Okay. So is there a classical solution with interesting killing fields that has this complicated topology?
Well, I don't know. Off the top of my head, I don't know the answer to that, but I guess I don't see a priori why.
I suppose, yeah.
You probably lose stuff.
Well,
the ones that are most
rotational variance.
Exactly. The ones that are
really interesting, but right. There, it'll generally be broken by the identification.
Indeed.
Sorry?
I'm wondering if I can preserve anything like one of these boost killing fields after the identifications, and I don't know. I don't know. So if there is a killing field to work with, then I suspect that something similar will be true. You objected that it's not clear what a neck is.
Well, I mean, you'll have different necks in different places.
So you make some, I think there's probably some reasonable definition. Maybe it's a matter of, let's see, different necks in different places. So are your spatial slices connected?
Not simply.
But they're connected. Okay. So this what I call the neck here, is a spatial slice.
So it can have holes and handles.
It could have non-trivial topology, but it has topology of whatever the spatial slice is. So it's basically, I mean, in this case, I chose something that, it's basically a surface of minimal volume, and I chose it, and you see that I was happy if there is not a unique such surface, so long as all such surfaces are related by these de Sitter transformations. So I might imagine something like that is true in your solution. I don't know. I haven't thought about it. It's an interesting question. My suspicion is that one could at least fix up this recipe to make it work. The use of this particular surface and this particular use of energy to regulate the calculation is not, strictly speaking, critical. It's really the easiest procedure to follow. You can soup it up in many ways that we can discuss. Lee, you might get a question.
Yeah, so I have a sort of programmatic question at the beginning.
Excellent.
So in Minkowski space-time,
yes.
If you ask the same questions, you would say the Poincaré transformations are not gauged.
True.
Because in constructing the Hamiltonian, there are boundary terms that allow us to separate gauge from symmetry.
Correct.
And you would say, therefore, there are conventional notions of local observables.
Yes.
But somehow they require this map.
There are conventional notions of local observables
in
Minkowski space.
But somehow,
conventional notions?
Well, the usual, we could do usual perturbative quantum gravity.
We could do usual perturbative quantum gravity, yes. Yes, yes. Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
And they have well defined observables.
Yes.
But somehow, implicitly,
yes.
They exist because of this non local structure that there are boundary terms in the Hamiltonian.
Yes.
And implicitly, if you wanted to get philosophical, that's because one is not doing quantum cosmology, there are observers.
Correct.
At infinity. So all of this is investigation of the consequences of trying to do quantum cosmology.
Correct.
Without observers in infinity.
Correct.
And the issue is that since the existence of local observables in the first place depends implicitly on observers in infinity, without them the notion of local observables is in trouble and you're trying to rescue.
Correct.
And then it's a detailed question whether you, to what extent you succeeded and to what extent there are still issues.
That's right. And to what extent this really is a good toy model for this more general problem that you've set. But that's the idea. That's the motivation behind it. That's the philosophy of why I feel like this is a good toy model for more general issues in quantum gravity.
Let me follow up on, I mean, I agree 100% with everything makes sense.
Except?
No, everything.
Oh.
But we could still pretend that there weren't observed. I mean,
we could
treat Minkowski space as a mathematical
playground
for this
issue. We could.
we could pretend the word observer is infinity
right.
And so on and say that every observable has to clear.
Or perhaps it's even possible to find some more clever choices of asymptotically flat boundary or asymptotically something boundary conditions that makes that true. In the spirit of my talk from Tuesday, maybe there's a way of making those things gauge. Yeah. Right.
So what would help you give us a little hint that things are simpler? Can you pull, carry, or are you trying to carry through the whole
program
in Minkowski space, and does it work?
It works better in Minkowski space. Strictly speaking, this is also work in progress, but it works better in the sense that these correlators for arbitrarily large numbers of O's are now finite. So the original prescription of just trying to define an operator by integrating something like this for good choices of A seems to work well. It gives you some really densely defined operator on some invariant domain in the Fock space, it appears. There is a decay, it's just polynomial instead of exponential.
In time,
indeed. It depends what you call a mode. Any normalizable wave packet disperses in Minkowski space. Okay. So, you know, that's a technical issue. Certainly plane waves don't disperse, but normalizable modes do disperse. And that polynomial, some obvious word I'm missing here, but the polynomial dispersal is exactly what gives you control over this. That together with, I should say, sorry, in Minkowski space, you have two tools to use. One is the polynomial dispersion. The other is the fact that there is a well-defined global time-like killing field, which gives you a notion of positivity of energy that you can use to show, well, to calculate with, and that controls some of these terms. It gives you a zero multiplying the volume divergence I discussed. So that's a key point.
So in that case, you know, so you've shown us a large number of observables with some clear, relatively clear physics.
Somewhat clear, yes,
you
yes.
You know what, Frank, but you could also just define the observable sub-algebra, right? There's the commute of the constraints, which in this case is
yes.
the trend.
Yes.
Generators. Do you know yes. what fraction of those you can produce, you have produced in this algebra? I was going to ask you the same in the sitter, but maybe it's.
I don't, strictly speaking, know.
Did you suspect it's the whole algebra?
I suspect it's a very large part of the algebra. But I'd have to think a minute before I give you a good argument for that. Yeah. I mean, it's... So let me say it this way. We know that the Hilbert space that we want is in some sense built by taking the vacuum, acting with local field operators, and then making the states de Sitter invariant, Poincaré invariant, what have you. That's the recipe I want to use. So this method of construction allows you to do very similar things. You can put arbitrary numbers of field operators in the interior here. Okay. And yeah. Well, I should say that what I, in order, let's do the Minkowski case, okay? In the Minkowski case, I think to really get a good dense set of observables, it may not be sufficient to take single integrals of local arguments. You may need to allow yourself to integrate over things that have some sort of fixed separation. Things that correspond to acting with a local field here and a local field here, and then maybe smearing that whole thing over the Poincaré group. But there's some sense in which you allow yourself to do that, that a rough heuristic counting of the number of degrees of freedom gives you roughly the right answer. So I think that may be a key point.
Maybe, then I'll shut up.
Okay.
Just name one challenge, one operator.
Great.
Ask if you could get it.
Okay.
So again, it's in Minkowski's space.
Yeah.
So there'd be the total four momentum squared. That's an invariant operator.
So I said most of them.
Integral, but it's only integral over a space time. Over
correct.
So can you be, by averaging or something, get that into your four above the space
time? Not by averaging, but by something you might consider a cheat. So let me take your example, that we take the Minkowski theory, and we make it into a theory where Poincaré transformations are gauge. Okay, all right. Then, I could say it this way, without having said anything more, it's clear that if Poincaré transformations are gauge, and if all the observables then commute with the Poincaré transformations, okay, that the value of something like p squared is a superselected operator. Okay? So on each Hilbert space, it's a constant. Okay, so I can make constants. So I think that's the right answer to your question, though. Meaning that that's the way that's the status that I think your operator deserves in this construction.
You said in the introduction that you had a sensible definition of Boltzmann break. What is that?
I didn't quite say that. What I said is that the heuristic idea of a Boltzmann brain is connected to the issue that I did discuss of these divergences. So why is that? So people in doing cosmology and in de Sitter space sometimes talk about these things called Boltzmann brains. You will sometimes, this is not the precise part, this is repeating some sort of standard words, give you a flavor of the discussion. People sometimes ask the question, what do typical observers in de Sitter space see? They notice that de Sitter space has this thermal or vacuum quantum fluctuations, and therefore, if you look over some large region of de Sitter space, you know, there are fluctuations happening in each small region. If you look at a large enough region, well, surely in a given region of de Sitter space, since the vacuum is in some sense thermal, there's some probability that an observer might just appear there. It's called a Boltzmann brain. You've got a thermal ensemble, okay? One of the possible states that appears in the sum in the partition function is a state that has an observer in it. That one could be there with some small Boltzmann wave. So if you look over some large enough volume of space-time, surely there'll be at least one such creature there. I make the connection. So I repeat the usual story. Now I'll explain the connection. Oh, the complaint is then, well, perhaps this makes it hard to tell what happens for observables or something in de Sitter space because where is the observer? Is it the observer that you want to put in? Or are you actually going to see, will the observer actually, will something happen from these Boltzmann brains that contributes? So what's the story? The essential part of this idea is that there are quantum fluctuations, okay, which in de Sitter space have a kind of a thermal nature. That's all true. Clearly, the nature of quantum fluctuations in the vacuum affects our story as well. It comes up everywhere in quantum field theory and de Sitter space, quantum field theory in any context. So where do these vacuum fluctuations come up? Well, as I said, so each of our operators were sort of the integral over the whole space-time of something that looks around for a kind of detector-like object, like the crossing of these particles, and then tries to measure some other field at that point. So, you know, our operators, again, they scan through space, and they kind of look for where these particles cross. Now, by the same logic, you'd say that, well, surely there are vacuum fluctuations such that our operators would find Boltzmann particle crossings somewhere out there in de Sitter space, even if we're in the vacuum state. True. So it's clear how to deal with that technically, though, in our language. What we're doing is, of course, we're our field operators that we are integrating over space-time, we will take to be normal ordered or, you know, renormalized in some place. Effectively, we subtract off such contributions from this small amplitude that you might find particle crossings in the vacuum in this language. Okay. What's interesting is that having removed this issue of vacuum fluctuations from the one-point functions, that if we do nothing further, it comes back in our two-point function. For our simple observables that were just integrals over the space-time, it is exactly this issue of vacuum fluctuations. It was the contribution to the two-point function from the vacuum correlator that gave me my divergences, and I still find an issue here in making these things well-defined. The way that we got around this issue was, as you recall, to ask a different kind of questions in which I used as an important ingredient in asking the question some information that was not encoded in local operators. I asked about, for example, the total energy on an entire slice. Or there are other ways of doing this that make use of the really global notion of the quantum state to pick out, you know, what are the appropriate states for my observable to respond to and which ones don't. Okay, so that's the connection. Make of it what you will. Okay, but you see that there is an issue that arises in our calculation due to the fact that really the root of this is that the vacuum is never exactly an eigenstate of any truly local operator. And therefore, if you want to make something where you can integrate arbitrarily over the entire
non-compact space, you typically need to insert some kind of non-local or global information so that this doesn't give you problems in the vacuum.
Is that an infrared divergence?
That's an infrared divergence, exactly.
Good luck. Okay. One question, so this is going to be the last one.
Yeah.
Okay.
Because it's the same question.
I promised you a private discussion later, but
this is important because the message that I came from this discussion
yeah.
seems to be independent of the group structure. You
sure.
could rely on it and also a very nice setting like the center to show this, which is very nice.
Mm-hmm.
The message seems to be, and I'd like to comment on this, whether it depends on the base space and in particular whether there's a good of motion or any symmetry. So it's similar to
yeah.
what Rob is asking.
Yeah.
Sorry. But it's really the compactness.
Sorry. The compactness of the space is critical aspect number one. Yes. There is
yeah,
plus one other ingredient.
Yeah.
Okay. It's important for this story about these divergences of two-point functions and so forth that the background space that I'm perturbing about not have a globally defined time-like, you know, nowhere vanishing, nowhere space-like killing field. If there's a real time translation on the space that is nowhere vanishing, okay, then you don't have this divergence of two-point functions problem. So that's related to the group structure. If I did this perturbing around the Einstein static universe or something, I would have a different story. Perturbing around a T2 cross R, the story would be slightly different. Again,
you're saying that you need the group structure in order for your statement to be quite proof, or you can relax it.
You mean and not have a group?
No, I mean the group structure. The last comment you said that you need one more in order to look at the 2-point. So, I just want to understand that point.
He said the problem would not arise if there was a global timeline.
Right.
Right.
So it's related to the group structure. There are, if you like, some groups. Maybe one can make it an algebraic statement. There are some groups which the problem wouldn't arise. There are certainly some space-times about which one perturbs where the problem doesn't arise.
Which would just really mean they weren't good laboratories for quantum gravity.
Possibly.
I mean, just at least in this aspect, I mean, you're yeah. interested in this because this is a little bit of what we think is sort of pervasive in quantum gravity.
Quantum cosmology, right. Quantum gravity in asymptotically flat spaces could be very different. Quantum gravity and asymptotically ADS, if interesting. Well, yeah, exactly. But yes. Okay.
Okay, let's see.
Thank you.